Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Cushman, author of the book The General Civil War, What Their Memoirs Can Teach Us Today. Stephen, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm very glad to be here.
And we're very glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. I am a professor of English, not of history, at the University of Virginia, where I've taught for 40 years. This is my 40th year. And I began as a writer of and a scholar of poetry, American poetry. And that has been my primary activity here. But somewhere in the late 1990s, I had finished a book and was looking for another project. And I found myself turning to a long-standing interest in the American Civil War. And that was a good moment for me because it seemed that historical interests were becoming more important in my discipline as well. So I began teaching and writing about the American Civil War. And now, what is it, 30 years later, I've just finished a third book about it. And that's been a major part of my activity as well.
I can see the linkage because it's not as though, poetry is an alien literary form to the Civil War. And yet your book is not about poetry, but about memoirs and the memoirs of a very select group of authors. What led you to write a book about the memoirs that were written by the generals of the Civil War?
My last Civil War book was called Belligerent Muse, Five Northern Writers and How They Shaped Our Understanding of the Civil War. That book came out in 2014 from North Carolina Press. And in it, the writers in it are Abraham Lincoln, Walt Whitman, William Tecumseh Sherman, Ambrose Bierce, and Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Some of those people have had a lot of things written about them, certainly Lincoln above all, but also Walt Whitman, also Ambrose Bierce. Nobody has really written about Chamberlain as a writer, and nobody had really written about Sherman as a writer. And when I finished that chapter on Sherman, in the course of working on that chapter, I came across Sherman's correspondence with Mark Twain, to whom he turned at several points asking advice about publishing a travel book that he had written. And it was though my ears popped, the scales fell from my eyes, and I realized that certainly in the case of Sherman, although we think of him primarily as a towering military figure, he also thought of himself as a writer. And I began to think about these big books that all came out at the end of the 19th century, some of them the early years of the 20th century, by these generals, many of whom suddenly found themselves turning amateur author. And I became very interested in the intersection there of literature and history, and the ways in which history writing, particularly by these figures at that time, had to have a certain literary component to it. So then I started just in the years that followed, accepting, as often is the case, invitations to speak or contribute essays here and there. And over the 7 years from 2014 to this year, to 2021, I put together this collection of explorations of generals' memoirs. And then I began to look for the threads, and lo and behold, they were actually there. And then I pushed a little deeper, and more things made sense and more things connected. And the final product is what you have.
One of the things I thought was really interesting as I was reading your book, and I found it to be very revelatory in a lot of ways, as it made me think about the subject, is how you're not just talking about a certain category of memoirs, in the sense being that the memoirs of the military commanders. You're also talking about a period of American literature that, you know, nowadays you have people writing memoirs and accounts to, you know, I explain themselves or cash in on their moment of celebrity. But you have this, what you describe is a period where there's a lag after the Civil War. And it's this window from the mid-1870s to the early 1890s where these books come out. And I thought that was pretty fascinating too, about how it's about a decade after. And as you explained, there is sort of a synergistic factor at play here in terms of what's going on. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate on that and explain why it was that you suddenly have this group of generals. And again, to be clear, on both sides of the Civil War divide, who suddenly decide to put pen to paper and to write these accounts. And what is it about these accounts that you find to be so useful for us today?
So that's a great question. And what I started to discover was that people began writing their memoirs right away. Younger junior people in the army, civilians, people from both sides, men, women, began writing right away in 1861. What happened is then that after the war, the major surge on the cultural front was in the book industry, the book business, and all kinds of things happened really in a very short time. The number of magazines doubled in the U.S., the number of newspapers nearly doubled in the U.S., the price of paper became much cheaper, and typesetting and presses became much more effective. Literacy increased, so much so that suddenly libraries were much more active. The founding of the American Library Association is 1876, right there in that decade. And so there's a kind of huge tidal wave of bookiness, books, book business. Combine that with the, particularly in the North, the incentive to cash in on a new market, and you have publishing giants like Appleton and Company, Charles Scribner and Sons, Harper Brothers in Philadelphia, J.B. Lippincott, all these large publishing houses suddenly see that they can begin to make a fair amount of money, one, because of the boom in the book business, and two, because of the retrospective interest in the Civil War. They start approaching various generals. They approach generals from both sides. And what you realize is that although people who were torn apart by the war were still struggling to reconcile with each other and with the other side after the war, actually business people were quite ready to play both sides of the game, to work both sides of the tracks. And so all of these houses started publishing works by authors from both sides. Joe Johnston's memoir comes out from Appleton in 1874, then follows Sherman from the same publisher in 1875. The same publisher publishes Richard Taylor, the Confederate Lieutenant General. The same publisher publishes Jefferson Davis's memoir. And so you, this is a really extraordinary phenomenon that's going on. On the one hand, here are rank and file Americans of all backgrounds trying to come to terms with this catastrophe, this disruption. And on the other hand, here are these commercial entrepreneurs who are just having a great time selling these books. And it's that moment that I became very interested in.
And as you explained, they're not just writing about the war in terms of this is how I remember it. They're also, it's a way of, as you already mentioned, how the country's coming to terms with it. And you demonstrate how so many of the politics of the 1870s and 1880s are reflected in this. I'm thinking here primarily about Richard Taylor's memoir, which is not just about, which is, you know, deconstruction and reconstruction. He's talking about that whole era as it's being looked on in its immediate aftermath. But it's also interesting because when you're talking about something like Joe Johnston's memoirs and William Sherman's memoirs in your chapter, you describe how they're talking about the same event from different vantage points, and how there's this fascinating process taking place that in a way is a microcosm of this reconciliation that's going to be playing out in the decades to follow.
Yeah, what's so interesting to me about, say, the Johnston Sherman episode and that particular chapter, which is the first of the chapters after the introduction in the book, they were not particularly close before. They're not one of those stories like, say, Longstreet and Grant, who were friends before the war and then fought on opposite sides. They didn't really have anything to do with each other before the war. During the war, they faced each other at least three times. First Manassas Bull Run, then in the Mississippi campaign, and then in the final campaign in the Carolinas. But it was after, it was beginning with the surrender negotiations in the Bennett farmhouse in April 1865, and then after the war, as they were writing their memoirs, and then after that as well, that they actually became quite close. And they I think, both in good faith, but also intentionally, performed a kind of reconciliatory dance with one another in which each one responded to the writings of the other, and they kept going, kept corresponding, and did form this close tie, so much so that there's the famous story about Johnston going to Sherman's funeral and, as popular memory has it, catching his death cold in as he was helping to observe the formalities for Sherman's funeral. I find this really interesting because I think it's almost inconceivable now that two enemies could do that kind of public work, both in writing and in their private lives. So I find that episode really interesting. I also find it really interesting that although Grant and Lee get pretty much all the attention for Appomattox, it really is the Johnston-Sherman surrender negotiations that end up affecting many, many more soldiers. And yet we don't really think about them anywhere near to the same extent that we think about Grant and Lee.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon that a little bit, because you describe how it's part of this process of developing the memory of the Civil War that's taking place. But you know, while you make you talk a lot about Sherman and Johnston's friendship in that chapter, you also make it clear that they're not exactly on the same page as to what happened during those surrender ceremonies.
Right.
And the differences that are still very much there.
Yes. No. I mean that I find that a very compelling and dramatic episode. For me, the antecedents are the last meeting. Apparently, what we know about it, the last meeting on the River Queen, Lincoln's steamboat, and at that meeting are Grant and Sherman and David Porter, the admiral, and they're trying to figure out what to do as the war ends and how to treat the South. And that's when you get the perhaps apocryphal statement by Lincoln, "Let him up easy. Let's not have a lot of revenge and reprisal." Sherman thinks that he's acting in that spirit when he meets with Johnston in the Bennett farmhouse, and basically it isn't content just to end military hostilities, but takes the bait that Johnston and Breckinridge, who's there as well, that they dangle before him, which is, why stop there? Why shouldn't we just acknowledge all existing state governments in place and go from there and sort of effect a sweeping reconciliation? And Sherman goes, well, that sounds like a great idea. And of course, by that point, when he sent the terms back to Washington, now President Johnson and Stanton, still the Secretary of War, just explode and write back to him that he's exceeded. Well, they send Grant down to see him to say, you've exceeded your military authority and this won't do at all. And of course, Sherman, who was very touchy and had a very short temper in a lot of ways, was mortified and humiliated and felt that he'd been betrayed. So he has to go back to Johnston a second time, and then they come up with the final terms, which are based on the same terms that Grant offered Lee at Appomattox. When you read the two accounts side by side, what you see is that each writer, Johnston and Sherman, each one is jockeying to cast himself as the one who's in control and really understands the situation, which of course in Sherman's case turns out not to have been the case.
Now, one of the things that I thought was a very interesting point, moving on to Taylor's book, which I checked this because I was amazed that I kind of missed this point, is that you describe roughly a half dozen memoirists, you know, very famous names, Grant and Sherman and Johnston, and you have Richard Taylor in there. And one of the things that distinguishes Richard Taylor from all the other memoirists you describe is he's the only one who didn't go to West Point. He did not graduate from the United States Military Academy. He went to Yale. And you use that point to make a very interesting observation about the role that classical literature plays in the composition of memoirs, particularly his. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain that classical parallel and how Taylor adopts it, or how Taylor adapts it in order to present his take on the war.
I find Taylor a really fascinating character. Douglas Saul Freeman ranks in his book The South to Posterity, ranks Taylor's memoir at the top of literary compositions produced by former Confederates. And the thing about Taylor that's interesting is if one had a scale of literary ambition of the generals that I look at, Taylor's at the top, probably with Sherman coming second, and he is an frighteningly learned person, or let's put it a different way, he wants you to think he's a frighteningly literate person, and he is at every point goes out of his way to make allusions to classical literature, to all kinds of military history, back into not only the classical world, but European, modern Europe, recently modern European history. And it's as though at all times, whenever he's talking about the American Civil War, his service, in which the most famous part of his service is, of course, being with Stonewall Jackson in the Valley Campaign. Whenever he's talking about those things, it's as though he wants you to look at those events through the lenses of a long tradition of learning and history that he himself, Richard Taylor, is shaping. And it makes it a very interesting book, really a very intimidating book in a lot of ways, as I think he meant it to be. But as I say at one point in that chapter, the nice thing about having all these digital engines available to us is it's not hard to find out pretty quickly to what he's referring, even when it seems to be an especially esoteric kind of allusion. At one point, what's particularly interesting is when he turns to the Valley Campaign of 1862, he starts to talk about it, and then he turns into an aside, and he thinks ahead to the later Valley Campaign, which is, of course, the one taken, prosecuted by Philip Sheridan. And whereas he Taylor loves the 1862 campaign of Jackson and thinks that is the best part of that of his memoir. He thinks that what happened in the Valley under Sheridan is basically a war crime, basically an abomination, and beyond the limits of civilized behavior. Well, what you realize is all these allusions and all this classical learning and all this erudition that Taylor has been marshaling, is for the purpose, at least at some point, of passing that judgment on Sheridan and all that Sheridan represents, which is a new kind of warfare that's not being conducted by cultivated people and gentlemen and officers with any kind of sense of moral obligation. And it's really a strong indictment. I don't think it's true. I think he fudges some things that he might have thought about in a different way. But clearly that seems to be what the thrust of all his learning and culture is to say, look at what I represent and look at what this new brand of warfare represents.
It's an interesting point that you return to when you talk later on in the book about McClellan, because there is this that idea of how there was a certain way to fight the war that was the traditional way, that was the gentlemanly way, and how the war gets resolved in a much more brutal fashion. And that, of course, you know, raises a much larger question. The Civil War is that, you know, was it more devastating to drag out the war and fight it the way that the gentlemen wanted, as the generals, you know, thought of themselves, or to fight it in the more brutal way that, say, Grant and Sherman employed, which, you know, ultimately ended the war in 1865 and not in, say, 1866 or 1867.
Yes. And this we can really see what's so interesting in the case of McClellan. And by the way, for those who don't know, McClellan's of the memoirs that I look at, McClellan's is the only one published posthumously. He died when he was rewriting it. He lost his first manuscript in a fire, and he died while he was rewriting it. And the memoir we have is largely the posthumous work of his editor, William C. Prime. And Prime was a great friend of McClellan's and a political supporter and wanted him to look good. But what you do see, even through that's perhaps slanted lens of pro McClellan editing, what you do see is that from McClellan's point of view, the bewildering thing about his service in the war is the extent to which the nature of war and war aims changed right in front of him. And some people would say changed because of him, because of his of his, I don't know if you want to say failure, but the way that the Peninsula campaign turns out, it's quite clear to the people back in Washington that the old way of waging war, where perhaps you don't fight on the Sabbath and you conduct yourself like Christian gentlemen, isn't going to be adequate for what they are up against at this time. And McClellan, of course, finds this horrifying in much the same way that Richard Taylor did, that this is, we've gone into a new realm here where the new apostles are Grant and Sherman and Sheridan, and it's not so much about cruelty, although there is the famous statement by Sherman about war is cruelty, you cannot refine it, as it is about making war more humane by making it quicker. And of course, that's the same argument that many people advanced for the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japan, is mm-hmm. if we do this now, horrifying as this may be, it should shorten things. And of course, that's a particular way of waging war. And McClellan just was appalled by it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You mentioned how Taylor had came across as, you know, formidably learned in his book. And I don't think it's, you know, really that secret that he had these high literary aspirations for his memoir. And yet, as you make clear in the next chapter, the memoir today that we look to as being the great literary work of this group is Grant's personal memoirs, and how you have with that a work that people, you know, it's in many ways become the Caesar's commentaries of the Civil War, in that it does seem to be the outstanding literary work produced by a commander, the one that will likely endure for centuries to come, while people like, you know, memoirs like those of Taylor's become much more obscure.
Yeah, for Twain, and one of the people we haven't talked much about Mark Twain so far, but Mark Twain is a major presence through this book because he is the publisher of Sherman and McClellan and Sheridan. He actually then also does woo Sherman later on. He gets a third edition of Sherman's memoir out, so he's very much connected with all these Northern generals. And Twain always felt that Grant's memoir was miraculous. It was a great work of American literature, produced by somebody who did not have aspirations to write a great work of American literature. actually, Grant resisted and didn't want to write anything. And if he hadn't been swindled out of all his money and had to support his wife, he might never have written his book. Twain really, I think, got that book out of him. And everybody knows the story that Grant, of course, is racing terrible cancer by the point at which he's writing his memoir. The way I look at Grant is, I start off by asking, you know, the cliche about Grant is what makes his memoir so readable and so accessible is its great simplicity of style. And everybody writes, people who talk about Grant tend to say, well, isn't this something? I mean, what a humble, simple, straightforward guy. And of course, he wrote a humble, simple, straightforward book. And what I try to show is this isn't true at all, that in fact, Grant, as a young man, letters we have by him to then to Julia Dent, not yet his wife, but his fiance at that point, they show a guy experimenting with all kinds of writing styles, including some heavily influenced by, say, Charles Dickens or travel writing of the 19th century, very florid and meandering and indulgent and so forth. So the first point about Grant's memoir is his style in that book is an achieved style. It's a style that he had to develop. And in trying to figure out how he did develop his style, I decided that there were really three major influences on him. One is Lincoln, and that he began reading Lincoln he began reading transcripts of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And then, of course, he meets Lincoln later on when he comes east to command the army and becomes a regular correspondent of Lincoln's. Lincoln, I think, taught Grant the value and the power of indirectness and understatement and leaving some things unsaid. And Grant learned that lesson very quickly and very well. The second influence, I think, on Grant was actually Mark Twain. And this is fascinating because what you realize as you start to track it, Twain and Grant met in the 1860s, but by the time Grant dies, you realize that actually this is a circuit loop that they've been reading each other. And that Twain begins admiring Grant very early on for his unconditional surrender message to Simon Buckner at Donelson. But Grant has also been reading Twain. We know Grant read The Gilded Age and a lot of other, he probably read Huckleberry Finn, which was coming out at the same time that he was writing his memoirs. So what he learned from Twain, I think, is how to fashion a kind of literary mask. And I'll say a little more about that in just a second. And then the third influence, I think, on Grant was the telegraph, that when Grant became general of the army, you know, he was writing, the daylight would end and then Grant would be up much of the night writing communications. And he became a writer, and he became a writer in a new form that was about clarity, precision, directness. And I think you can feel the influence of the telegraph in much of Grant's memoir. The last thing I'll say about Grant is that what you realize from what he learned from Twain, I think, is the power of what you leave out. And what we know, I mean, we know that Grant had problems with drinking. And yet there's none of that in the memoir, not a single thing. We know that a major person in Grant's life is his wife, Julia, but she's mentioned only two or three times. There are many moments where we know that Grant, because of the kind of war he prosecuted, we know that Grant was responsible for thousands and thousands and thousands of casualties. And yet there's very little of that. There are a few vignettes, and basically what he says went at Shiloh and in a couple of other places is how sickened he was when he went near a field hospital or he saw a wounded man or something. And you realize that there's a lot about hard war, or what people call in Civil War scholarship now, the dark war, that Grant keeps off stage. He just keeps it out of the book. And that there's nothing straightforward or simple about that. That's a calculated decision by a narrator about what to include and what to exclude.
I thought your point about the Telegraph was especially fascinating because it makes me think about how, the way to which writing is a practice and something that you master through repetition. And you also bring in the Hemingway story about how when he was learning how to write, he was basically given the sort of direction as to how to become a writer that the Telegraph forces upon you. I mean, you're talking about a medium, and you make the analogy with Twitter, where you have a set number of characters that you can use. Telegraph's not restrictive in that sense, but you're constrained by expense, you're constrained by numbers to kind of make your messages as brief as possible. And there's also the fact that he's not just a writer of telegraphs, he's a recipient of them. And he had this ability to compare the Lincoln that he conversed with, and as you describe, he had stories told, with the Lincoln that he would have had to have received communications from via telegraph. And that comparison must have been influential as well.
I think that's an excellent point. I think one of the things he learned from both Lincoln and Twain was how a writer is a shapeshifter. And at a given moment, Lincoln could be anecdotal and off color and backslapping and droll and sly, but he also had to write telegrams that were setting in motion large events, such as the one that he writes to Sheridan during the Appomattox campaign, where Sheridan has said, "I think if the thing is pressed, we can bring this to a close." And Lincoln writes back the famous one-liner, "Let the thing be pressed." And that gets us into what Lincoln, how Lincoln became the writer he was. That's a subject I talk about in the previous book, Belligerent Muse, not this one, but it does bear on this, which is, I think Lincoln learned a huge amount about voice and tone and how to adopt different points of view just from being a lawyer, and that he had to take different sides of different issues and so on. And I think some of this rubbed off on Grant too. Grant was not a lawyer, but I think he started, Grant had a pretty good understanding on his own and from Lincoln about lots of different points of view and lots of different voices. And I think that he was able to move among them quite nimbly.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to read about Grant's memoirs, which are justly famous, and to compare them with what McClellan does. And you make a comparison on a variety of levels. You've already talked about how McClellan's memoirs had to be rewritten. McClellan dies before they're completed. They have to be assembled posthumously. But you also talk about how, whereas Grant, Grant's books, his memoir is about his entire life up to the end of the Civil War. He talks about the Civil War in most of it. So he's talking about a four-year period in it. McClellan is much more focused upon that much smaller window of time when he's much younger than Grant, where he is in command of the Army of the Potomac. So where his focus is upon that 18 months where he's in charge of the Army of the Potomac and involved in a lot of the key activities there.
Yes. The McClellan-Grant, I mean, that's so interesting, those two books, because the Grant is a, we haven't mentioned anything about this, but the Grant is a complete commercial success and a major blockbuster. In the end, Twain ends up paying Julia Grant between $10 and $11 million in our dollars today. It's an astonishing commercial success. And of course, Twain at that point thinks that anything he does is golden. And so whom should he get in touch with next? But the other very popular general, certainly among soldiers, who's McClellan. And you can tell that there's a commercial angle to this as well, because after McClellan dies, Nellie McClellan, McClellan's widow, is quite clearly interested in making money as well. But the big difference, at least rhetorically or narratively, between Grant and McClellan is that Grant gets to write with the confidence of probably the most celebrated American of his day. And McClellan has a very different agenda, which is to exonerate himself after a sharp downturn in his reputation. And so one of the things that you get in McClellan that you hardly see at all in Grant is McClellan loves counterfactuals. If Burnside had been more aggressive at the bridge at Sharpsburg Antietam, we would have won, and then this would have happened, and so on. And he has a tendency to do that quite a bit, and some people find that very irritating and just confirms their negative opinion of McClellan. I have a different feeling about that, which is that counterfactuals are what we do all the time. And, you know, if only this had happened, then this might have happened. And we historians, whether professional or amateur, homespun, are carrying out those kinds of thought experiments all the time. And McClellan does it in a way that some people find irksome, because after all, part of the code of being an officer is you just go with events and you don't sit around and second guess them. Particularly, you don't second guess your commander in chief, which unfortunately McClellan did a lot of. But it's actually quite a very human thing. And the other thing about McClellan's memoir that I find really very interesting and important is that whereas Grant is devoted to his wife, but puts her almost nowhere in his memoir, McClellan is devoted to his wife. And because of the decision of his editor, William Prime, McClellan's memoir turns out to be a kind of collage or pastiche of McClellan's narrative, but also many of his private letters to his wife that, of course, he, McClellan, would never have put in the memoir had he lived. But Prime puts them in there, and they actually give us a side of McClellan that I don't think a lot of people know, which is that he comes across all the time in many people's view as arrogant, well, very cautious and not as aggressive a warrior as he should be, but also complaining, self-justifying, whining all the time, asking Washington for more reinforcements and so on and so on. But the McClellan of the letters to his wife is a much more tentative, vulnerable, hesitant person. And I think it's a hugely important piece of understanding McClellan to know this, because without it, it's too easy to succumb to the caricature vision, which is that he had a bad case of the slows and was no good at anything except organizing an army, which everybody praised him for.
That's one of the things I really valued about your book, was that the way that you took the memoirs and used them to highlight points about people that seem so well-defined in our historical imagination. And yet you explain that the memoirs can show sides of them that we didn't appreciate. The counterfactual one is an excellent example, because that's there. And you're right. I mean, I that's something that, you know, I read, you know, at face value as, you know, him basically saying, you know, effectively shifting blame on others. Another aspect of that, where you do that with McClellan that I thought was fascinating was his references to the Almighty. Because again, on a surface level, I could read that as it's his way of saying that in the end, it was God's will. And you know, and that's, you know, and so McClellan's not really at fault. But you use it instead to talk about how McClellan is a man of faith in a way that we don't easily appreciate from that caricature that you just referenced.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, let's say any of the great monuments of recent Civil War memory, let's say Ken Burns's 1990 series or Jim McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom or whatever you choose, you know, if you were to say, okay, religious generals, who comes to mind? Well, you're going to say Stonewall Jackson. You might say Leonidas Polk. You might say Rosecrans on the northern side. No, nobody says McClellan, and yet And yet when you actually dig in and start reading, you realize, and his conversion largely comes with his marriage to Nellie. And she's quite a Calvinist. What you realize is when he went into his generalship, quite determined to do what he thought was the will of God, and not in any kind of messianic way, as much as if the Lord says, keep the Sabbath holy, then he issues an order to his troops saying, do as little as possible on the Sabbath. Or if your enemy is suffering, with the wounded of your enemy are suffering, send the enemy bandages and quinine and lemons, and these things he did send to Lee to be used for his men. And McClellan is trying to wage war as what he understands a Christian to be. He is trying to wage Christian warfare. A lot of people would say that's an oxymoron, that's a paradox. That still was what McClellan was trying to do. And we don't think about him that way. And so one of the ways to think about, say, his notorious caution is that he is trying to be the kind of responsible moral warrior that he understands he should be.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to an earlier point that you make in the book, which is you talk about the you mentioned in the book that with Sherman's memoirs and Grant's memoirs, they've been immortalized in a way by being part of the famous Library of America series, which endeavors to keep them in print for all eternity. And the contrast in my mind between those books, which are very easy to acquire today and easy to read, with that of Philip Sheridan, who, I'll be honest, before I read your book, I wasn't even had written a memoir. And yet you in your chapter, you make a case that Sheridan's book may not have the stature of Grant's or Sherman's as a memoir by a leading Union commander, but it is nonetheless one that has a considerable merit to it and offers something a little different and that enriches this whole genre.
I think it's very true. I was amazed to start reading not only Sheridan's memoir, but also his correspondence about the memoir, again with Mark Twain. And I think in Sheridan's case, you have a very instructive example of the workings of the Civil War memory market, because by the time that Sheridan is writing. And remember, when Sheridan is writing, he too is a very popular figure. He's being talked about as a possible presidential candidate. And his people are trying to capitalize on his fame in many of the same ways as the other figures we've been talking about. What you see in the case of Sheridan is that by 1888, the Civil War book market has become saturated. And Fred Hall, who is an associate of Mark Twain's at Charles Webster and Son Twain's publishing company, is writing Twain saying of Sheridan's memoir, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to sell this because everybody's writing Civil War memoirs and there are so many of them. And so I think that it's not an accident that you did not know that Sheridan even wrote one, because by the time you've read 1,000 pages of Grant and 1,000 pages of Sherman, who wants to read 1,000 pages of Sheridan? Sheridan is number three on that Mount Rushmore trilogy. He ranks third. And a lot of people just are exhausted by the time they start thinking about him, both now and back then in the 1880s. The point I make about Sheridan is that he was very much a can-do kind of person, both as a warrior and as a writer. And when Twain approached him and said, how about writing your memoirs? Basically, Sheridan said, okay, that sounds like an interesting thing to do. And what does he do but take as a model Grant? And he's very much writing in the wake of Grant's success, Grant's memoir, and a lot of the conversation among people in Twain's publishing house is, oh dear, we hope Phil Sheridan doesn't think he should sell as many copies as Grant, because of course, because of course he won't. But he is proceeding in that kind of practical, matter-of-fact way. Sheridan turns out to be a very good storyteller and to have a wide range of sensibilities and responses. What I love about Sheridan's memoir is his unabashed frankness about his own, well, you could call it insubordination, and that he won't be... He has a very early incident at West Point where he's suspended for a year for almost attacking an older cadet, and he follows that pattern right on through, including up to Grant really wanted Sheridan to go down towards Sherman and work for Sheridan, and Sheridan said that he'd rather have hot tar poured up his nose. He didn't want any part of that. He wanted to be his own independent agent. And as it turned out, you have to give a lot of credit for the Appomattox campaign to the pace at which Sheridan conducted warfare. So one of the things that I talk about in the Sheridan chapter that I think is really worth thinking about in all memoirs, not just generals, is what the concept of what the philosopher Thomas Nagel calls moral luck, that if you take a risk and it turns out badly, then everyone's going to say, oh, you made a really bad moral choice. But if you take a risk and it turns out well, then suddenly some people say, well, that was the right thing to do. And in Sheridan's case, the really pleasing thing, at least narratively, or satisfying thing narratively, is he does risk a lot, and it ends up paying off for him, and so that's what makes that book so satisfying, I think, in many ways.
You conclude your book with a chapter that's not on a general, but about the person who, in effect, makes so much of this possible, and the opening sentence I think does a really nice job of detailing why you do, which is, you say, without Mark Twain, the Civil War memory market would not have developed as it did, and without the Civil War, there never would have been a Mark Twain. It's fascinating to think about how you have this this one figure who casts this large shadow over this genre, and yet he served just a few months in the war, and who never really wore a proper uniform, much less ever had shoulder straps to wear during it.
Yeah, and yet, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry. Well, he actually served 2 weeks. he served 2 weeks as a partisan in Missouri, fighting nominally on the side of the Confederacy, although sides were a little strange in Missouri at that point. And so some people have said, well, that Twain's interest in Grant and Twain's interest in the war subsequently was sort of compensatory, as though he's working off guilt for having been a deserter, because he, after 2 weeks of his partisan irregular service, he said no thanks, and he went off to Nevada, and that's where he starts to become Mark Twain and use that pen name. But I think I think Twain is a hugely important figure for so many reasons, one of which is he understands the moment commercially, but also psychologically and culturally, that this is a moment that people want these stories from these leading figures. He also, and we haven't spoken about this yet so far, Mark Twain is only the author of the greatest first-person narrative experiment in American literature of the 19th century, in Huckleberry Finn. What strings these memoirs together is their use of the first person I. And we say, well, of course, that's how memoirs work. But that's not how they worked from the beginning. Caesar's commentaries are in the third person. Xenophon's Anabasis is in the third person. Even Winfield Scott's memoirs are in the third person, talking about Winfield Scott. The use of the first person as the sort of natural default mode for memoir writing was a very new thing in the middle to late part of the 19th century. And I think Twain grasped this. I think he grasped the importance of this, that he saw a moment where the public and the private, the public and the personal, converged in ways that would forever reshape the way Americans think about their own history and their own politics. And I think we can see that. I think we're living out that convergence of the personal and the public right now. Mm.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'd be happy to. I'm doing a couple of things. My colleague, now retired, alas for me, but hurrah for him, Gary W. Gallagher and I have been editing books that are collections of essays about iconic works of the Civil War period. And we just brought out a second one. And we're now beginning to sink towards a third, collecting more essays on significant works of the Civil War period. I'm also beginning to think now towards my next prose project. And I have a few ideas in mind. There are some figures I'd like to look at whose memoirs are still out there. And I haven't yet done this with them yet. I won't name any names because if I change my mind, I don't want anybody reminding me that I said this before. and then the last thing is I actually have a new book of poems in production right now. So those will be coming out in 2022.
Oh, well, it sounds like you're very busy. So thank you very much for spending some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you, Mark. I've really enjoyed this. Thanks so much.